in terms of the enslavement in Egypt, there seems to be a certain progression. We've been working with the Sforno. It's not altogether clear. The Torah doesn't point out to you all the things you would like to know. They did such and such because of such and such. It doesn't give you those kinds of explanations. It leaves it in a more general way, and you sort of have to try and figure it out. It gives only minimal information, for example, in terms of what triggered the reaction of the king. And we said that the explosion of the Jewish people, the tremendous increase in the Jewish people, that they became a separate entity and a nation, caused a fear, an insecurity to emerge. And then he more or less expresses it. The depiction of the Jews as a fifth column, that they're a disloyal entity, and that when a war would come, they would join with the enemy. The way the Sforno learns the next pasuk is really fascinating. Because it doesn't tell you, it just says, let us come and deal wisely with them. That's very important. The Jews should always remember that. There's all different types of enemies out there. Some of them are very loud and shrill and make a lot of noise, but they're not that dangerous. But the dangerous ones are the ones who are able to keep quiet about it and to use deviousness and chachma, wisdom. Of course, anti-Semitism is a very powerful emotion, so very often people are just consumed with it and they can't control it, they just act it out. They're not as dangerous as the ones that are clever and are able to masquerade and keep it quiet. So the real dangerous forms of anti-Semitism are those that try to, for example, depict Israel as the oppressor and the poor Palestinians and their only want self-determination. That type of corrupt thinking is really anti-Semitism. That's all it is. But they're able to control themselves and to rationalize it and put it in a different form, which has a certain appeal to simple-minded people. That's more dangerous. The progression seems to be that at first the objective was the Olam min ha'aretz. As this, the way the Sforno learns that pasuk is beautiful, and that the Havan Eschakmalo, come and let us deal wisely with him, is connected to the last phrase. The objective of dealing wisely will be that he will uproot himself from the land. And the middle part is the rationale, the explanation, the justification. He has to provide a justification for what he's doing. Continuing along these lines, so what did they do? They sought to make the situation painful for them. That is, by imposing a tax of labor, in order to afflict them with their labor. Apparently, the Egyptians at this point miscalculated, because they thought that this people would not put up with this, and they would leave the land. But it didn't work. They built storage cities, Pitom and Ramses. Now, the Sforno comments, and they built store cities, but however they accepted upon themselves the task of building these cities. There's Midrashim to the effect. There are Midrashim to the effect that Paro had to use subterfuge, that he made it appear as though this was some patriotic objective, and he himself came out on the first day and participated in the work, and it seems that he appealed to the Jews a certain sense of that they should be patriotic, they should be loyal, they should be willing to do it. And it seems from what the Sforno was saying that the Jews accepted it upon themselves. I'm reading from the commentary of Rabbi Pelkowitz on the Sforno. This is his commentary. Ironically, the Jews accepted upon themselves as a civic duty the building of these cities, and voluntarily subjected themselves. This subjection resulted in their total subjugation. How did they permit themselves such folly? The Sferno answers that the transgressions of man cause reason to flee and wisdom to depart from him. This is a quotation from, because the next verse in the Sforno, that the Egyptians, by Avidu Mitzrayim, the Egyptians enslaved them. So the Sforno says, when the Egyptians observed how the Jews degraded themselves and were willing to occupy themselves with such base labor, they made them into slaves. All this resulted because the Jews continued to add sin upon sin. So they were deprived of reason and progressed from evil to evil. It's a very strong condemnation. It's obvious that the Sforno is learning. This is another question. I don't know if we'll take it up today, but it's been on my mind as to how we're supposed to understand the entire enslavement. Is this simply something that happened as a result of natural causes? Or was this something which was brought down upon the Jews by the will of God? It wasn't just an accident. If it would seem, just superficially, that this was not just an accidental phenomenon, that this was something that had a purpose, because God had communicated to Abraham in the Bris Ben Hapsarim, the covenant between the parts, that know that your children will be slaves in a land which is not theirs, and they will enslave them and afflict them. And then God is saying, then I will redeem them, remove them. So you just get a certain sense that this was an important piece of information, that this was an important component in the development of the Jewish people. And thus the question is, why? But aside from that, how are we to understand it? Is it a punishment? Are we to understand it as punishment, that for whatever the sin, the Jews deserved to be enslaved? Or not? It wasn't a punishment, it was just something which was necessary. It was a necessity, perhaps. Was it a necessity? Sometimes you have to go through certain experiences. Let me explain. For example, if you join the army, or you have an army, so soldiers are subjected to very grueling kind of training. And they devise all these different types of exercises and missions in the field to imitate the battlefield conditions. So, or they go on treks. They may subject them to mock capture, interrogation, whatever it is. So there's a lot of affliction. Of course, the people who do so enter it willingly. But let's say it was conscription. Let's say it wasn't entered into willingly. Let's say you were drafted to be a soldier. So then why are these people being subjected to all of this pain and suffering? Most people would reject the question. They would say it's a necessary phenomenon, given that there's enemies and you have to defend yourself and you need to have an army. So the only way to have an army is to have training, and training itself means that you have to endure certain conditions which may not ever come to pass. May not come to pass because the fact that you have an army which can defend itself is a deterrent, but it may come to pass. So you can't argue and say, why are these people being subjected to this harsh treatment? Forced marches and going for days without sleep and all of that. Because you recognize the purpose. It has a purpose. So it doesn't mean that there's a punishment over here. It's just that it's something which is necessary in order to achieve a purpose. I'm sort of asking that question over here. How are we to understand the enslavement? Is that something which was necessary in order to achieve a purpose? Or it's something which was a punishment, has to be viewed as a punishment that the Jews were deserving of? All right, we're not going to pursue that line right now. We'll come back to that. It does seem, however, from the Sforno that it's not something which had to be, that it's not inevitable, that it's, I guess if you want to put it in the form of a punishment, I don't know if it's divine punishment. Sometimes the punishment is that you bring about through mistakes, through foolishness, you can contribute to your own downfall. That's the way the Sforno seems to be learning it. And he seems to be pointing to a certain defect in the Jews. He's very critical of the Jews. And I think it would be interesting. What then is the weakness that he's pointing to? He's saying that the Jews accepted this upon themselves. And the Egyptians saw this, and this encouraged them to go further. So what is the defect that he's pointing out to in the Jews? It seems that the Jews could have resisted. When you look back at a lot of things, things seem inevitable. You look back at persecution, you look back at the Holocaust, and everything seems inevitable. What could these people have done? Well, it's very difficult at this juncture when there's no point, first of all, there's no point in being critical of people that went through such torment. That's not the purpose of studying. But still, we want to learn from this. And you have to inquire. Was it mistakes? Were mistakes made? Had the Jews acted differently? Could they have avoided the calamity? As we've seen, there's a big similarity between the way the Sforno describes it. Originally, according to the Sforno, the objective was expulsion. But it didn't succeed. Here, the Jews apparently didn't get the message. The message of the forced labor was that this is a hostile environment. That is, we don't regard you as true citizens. And we're going to exploit you. How should the Jews have reacted? Well, there are two ways they could have reacted. One way could have been with great resistance. It's hard to say what would have happened, and the same is true in Europe, the same is true throughout history. There weren't that many instances in which the Jews resisted. It's hard to know what would have happened, but it seems to me that the Jews sometimes adopted a certain attitude of passivity, that it's inevitable, and didn't take the approach of self-defense, of fighting back. Again, I can't go through all the cases of history, and I don't mean to judge anyone. You have to be in the situation. You shouldn't judge others until you've been in the situation. So I don't mean it in that way. But it just does. It seems to be the case that the idea of Jews standing up for their rights and fighting back, well, as I said, it could be that it was simply an impossibility. You have to be in the situation. And maybe had they done it that way, they would have been wiped out. Maybe they just had no choice, and in order to survive, they had to put up with a lot. And they suffered a great deal. There was a lot of persecutions, but the truth of the matter is the Jewish people did survive. It's very hard to make a judgment on this. The idea of Jews standing up for their rights and defending themselves is a recent phenomenon. It seems to come into being pretty much, well, after the Holocaust, but even, you know, with the Enlightenment, with the development of new kinds of societies, that are more democratic, and where people, citizens, have rights. So even though there's anti-Semitism, but there's certain types of redress. In this situation, the Jews, you would have thought that they would have resisted. Had they resisted? Well, I don't know. I don't know what the Egyptian response would have been. Or they would have gotten the message and left. They didn't do either one of these things. So apparently that idea that the exile, to Egypt was a temporary phenomenon, and the attitude should be that as soon as we can get out of here, we should get out of here. Apparently they didn't have that attitude. Doesn't seem that way. It doesn't seem that there was any kind of a leadership. And that's one of the factors. It points out that entire generation There was something unique about the generation that came down to Egypt originally. Then there's a new phase, and it just seems that there was no leadership, and that the attitude was simply that we're Egyptians. They began to obtain a identification with the Egyptians. If you take a look at the Rambam in Hilchos Avodas Chachamim, Laws of Idolatry, he gives the history of Avraham, but he continues with that history. And it would seem from the Rambam as well that the Jews were not without guilt, that the Jews strayed from the teachings of the fathers in Egypt. I'm just going to read a few sentences over here. That first Avram established the fundamental principle, the existence of the true God. And he taught it. He taught it to his son. He planted in their hearts this great fundamental principle, composed texts about it, that is, he wrote books, and taught it to Isaac, his son. Isaac also taught others and turned their hearts to God. He also taught Jacob and appointed him as teacher. Jacob taught others and turned the hearts of all those who gathered around him to God. He also taught all of his children. He selected Levi and appointed him as the leader. That was the role of the tribe of Levi, to be the teachers of the Jewish people. He established him as the head of the academy, and so to speak. He was in charge. So in every generation, there were leaders who were in charge of the philosophy, or the religion, whatever term you want to use, to teach them the way of God and observe the mitzvos, the commandments of Avraham. Jacob commanded his sons that the leadership should not depart from the descendants of Levi, so that the teachings would not be forgotten. This concept proceeded and gathered strength among the descendants of Jacob and those who collected around them, until there became a nation within the world which knew God. So basically this takes place in Egypt. What the Rambam is describing over here, the development of this nation, takes place in Egypt. So of course that's part of the divine plan, that a nation should develop. And the whole basis of the nation was that it was founded upon dedication to the true philosophical principles about the existence of God and the purpose of man. That was the uniqueness of this nation. Continuing now, when the Jews extended their stay in Egypt, however, they learned from the Egyptians' deeds and began worshipping the stars, as they did, with the exception of the tribe of Levi, who clung to the mitzvos of the patriarchs. The tribe of Levi never served false gods. Within a short time, the fundamental principle that Avraham had planted would have been uprooted, and the descendants of Jacob would have returned to the errors of the world and their crookedness. So this is taking place in Egypt. Now, this already is taking place in terms of the enslavement. Now the commentary over here mentions on the words they learned from the Egyptians' deeds and began worshipping the stars as they did. This is the commentator. When the Jews adopted Egyptian values as a reflection of their spiritual state, they were enslaved by the Egyptians. So he's connecting it to the enslavement. Well, it's clear, this is clearly in line with the Sforno, except it's adding another dimension, that it's not saying that the Jews retained their ideas, their religion, their philosophy. But, from a political standpoint, they regarded themselves as being Egyptians. That's one way you could look at it. You have that phenomenon. For example, in America, there's many religious Jews who keep the Torah. But, from a political standpoint, they identify themselves as Americans, and they don't want to leave America. However, what you have over here, the Sforno is pointing out to the fact that the Jews weren't disturbed by the imposition of this tax. They accepted it willingly, voluntarily. They didn't resist it. This would indicate a certain type of a desire to demonstrate their loyalty to Egypt. They wanted to be Egyptians. So that apparently, that would be a sin. Because it's not just a practical thing. It's more than that. They needed psychologically a certain type of a security. They didn't want to be regarded as outsiders. It also seems that there was no thought of returning to Canaan. Now, it's hard to know what the attitude was. What was the attitude that they had received from their leaders, going all the way back to Yaakov and Yosef? What was the established rule? Wait? Was the established rule just wait and don't try and leave and don't try and go back? Which pretty much was the established rule throughout all the centuries of the exile. There was no real thought of leaving the exile. Of course, the Jews would be expelled from time to time, from one country to the next, but the idea of actually terminating the exile and going back to Israel and recreating a situation in Israel, that didn't come into being until the Zionist movement. I mean, there were a few people that had the idea from time to time, but that was the Zionist movement, and it certainly wasn't, when it first started, it wasn't accepted by most of the rabbinical leaders. I don't know what the situation was. The attitude of the religious leaders, pretty much, was that we're in exile, and there's nothing we can do about it, and it will not be terminated until the time. That is, God will eventually remove us from the exile. The idea of the Jews taking matters into their own hands and uprooting the exile and forcefully establishing a different kind of an existence, a state in Israel, that was rejected by most of the rabbinical leaders as a violation, as a sacrilegious type of phenomenon. That was the basis of the opposition. Not all religious leaders looked at it that way. Now, of course, the idea of Israel is much more accepted and more popular. However, the Rambam is adding a different dimension, which I think goes along with the Sephorno. There's two different aspects of the identification. The first is with the culture, with the political, with the national aspect. And you want to be known as an Egyptian. It doesn't take very long until, obviously, if that's the case, then you're going to have to identify with them in terms of the religious. Because the religious divide between the Jews and the idol worshippers is simply too great. They'll never accept you. That's a tremendous breach. So it would seem then, according to the Rambam and according to the Sforno, that they had lost something. They should have regarded themselves as separate, as different. Indeed, we have a clearer understanding now. When we go back, when Yosef made the decision that they all have to come down to Egypt, you see that Yaakov was reluctant. Yaakov was very, very afraid. And one can understand why. The phenomenon of assimilation. In Canaan, they had an independent situation. They didn't have to worry about that phenomenon. In Egypt, it would be different. God reassured Yaakov that he should go down there. Yosef tried to establish conditions in which they would be able to exist within that alien culture and not become assimilated. He set up Goshen. Lahoros Lafanov, he sent Yehuda to establish, Rashi says, to establish a yeshiva. That's not the plain meaning. The plain meaning was they chose a place which was very well suited, where they could be separate from the... Every country has areas which you could have some type of separation, seclusion. Perhaps, I mean, just for purposes of description, not to make any comparison, but you have, even in America, you have the Amish. They set up their own they set up their own enclaves and separate themselves because their way of life is different. They do not, they don't identify with the American culture. Now, it's not a way of life that we would endorse, whatever the reasons. But in terms of being separate and not being caught up by the culture, it's not perfect either, but it's necessary. It would seem that that principle of being separated was lost. Something happened. We don't know the particulars, but that was lost. And maybe it had to do with the length of length, duration, and the increase in population and sort of moving into the land. So all of these things produced a different attitude. It evoked the hostility of the king. And from a mental standpoint, the Jews were not prepared to deal with it. They were not prepared to resist it. To the contrary, it seems that they wanted an opportunity to demonstrate their loyalty. And that's what the Sforno was saying. This, of course, had the opposite effect, that the Egyptians got the point. They discovered the weakness of the Jews and that they would not resist. All these things are extremely important. All these things are extremely important. Extremely important. And it has a lot of relevance to many situations today, whether it be Israel dealing with the Arabs and so forth. It's generally speaking a mistake when you try to appease, when you make concessions, when you try to appear to your enemy as though you're reasonable and so on and so forth. That's a dangerous type of an approach, because in most cases, you have to presume the worst about your enemies. In most cases, they don't appreciate. People do not appreciate. Your enemies don't appreciate anything you do. And generally speaking, they regard it as weakness. And it only encourages them to go for more. At the end of the day, it's very hard to hide that. People can spot your weakness. A lot of times we do things out of weakness. And we try to pretend that it's really niceness. But the other side recognizes it. I mean, you even have that with children, just on a trivial level, where you give in to the child, and the child learns that you're vulnerable. Then, of course, you try and pretend it's because you're so generous and so nice, and you don't want him to be hurt, so you're doing this and that for him. But the child knows that he was successful in whether it's crying, yelling, screaming, complaining, that you finally got tired and you just gave in. So you can be sure it's going to happen again. Okay. This tax, this labor tax, did not have the desired effect. That is, the Jews did not leave the land. According to the Sforno, that was the objective. To the contrary, they continued to expand. Kashayanu oso. As much as they would afflict them, or in spite of the fact that they afflicted them, Ken Yerbe V'Ken Yifrotz. They continued, they multiplied, and they spread out. So it was ineffectual. And they became disgusted by Yakutsu, Mipnei B'nei Yisrael, because of the children of Israel. Interesting. We now go to the next phase. And that is Vayavidu Mitzrayim es Bnei Yisrael b'farach, that the Egyptians enslaved the children of Israel with crushing harshness. Translating. I'm just reading the translation. Backbreaking labor. and they embittered their lives with hard work, with bricks and mortar, and all manner of work in the field. As the Ramban explains, as we said yesterday, it's backbreaking and also a certain element of degrading. Any type of work that they would do, every labor of the field, implying that there was nothing that was too harsh or degrading. It then continues, what's the connection? Then it says that the king of Egypt instructed the midwives, the Jewish midwives, Shifra and Puah, with the order to kill, to abort, infanticide, all of the male children. It would seem that those two things, the embitterment and the directive, because we're not given an explanation as to why he ordered that, why the king ordered that, and what's the connection between the order of infanticide and the embitterment of their lives. This seems to be the second phase. Clearly, it's not the first phase in which they built these storage cities. By the way, the connection that we made between the Rambam and the Sforno, in the very next comment of the Sforno on Pasuk 14, and they made their lives bitter, here's the commentary of the Sforno. Quote, as the Jews continued to sin in beliefs and practices, as the prophet testifies, now he quotes Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 8, which says, sort of depicts, goes over, reviews the history of the Jews, and says, but they rebelled against me and would not hearken unto me. They did not, every man, cast away the detestable things of their eyes. It's a reference to the idols. Neither did they forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said I would pour out my fury upon them, to spend my anger upon them in the midst of the land of Egypt. Now, getting back, that's the end of the quotation from Ezekiel. Says the Sforno, quote, so did the hand of the oppressor increase in severity. So it's clear that the Sforno learns that pasuk to be a reference to this particular time, which is in agreement with the Rambam, that there were two aspects of the breakdown and the attempt to identify with the Egyptian culture. It could not just be limited to one area. Once they viewed themselves or had a desire to be accepted by Egypt, so they had to give up their religion as well. That's how this Forno learns. In terms of the phenomenon of Ayakutsu, it seems that the attitude of the Egyptians underwent a change as well. That originally, for whatever reason, their approach to the Jews was based upon a fear. And they were trying to come up with a rational means of dealing with the problem. But there were barriers. Bear in mind that the Egyptians had to go through a transformation, because these people were there for a while. They had been there for about 100 years, whatever it was, and there was a history. They had come in. They were the descendants, they were the family of Joseph, and they had made contributions to the country, so they were accepted. Now, all of a sudden, to start abusing them, it's difficult for people to do this. There has to be from a psychological standpoint, there's got to be a transformation. In phase one, they were not expressing hatred. Phase one wasn't that painful. You didn't have any of these elements. They didn't attack them. They imposed taxes upon them. That's different. It wasn't backbreaking labor, it was a tax. So that could be justified. Look how they've benefited from our country. They forget already the favor that Joseph did. That's what the pasuk says. They didn't know Joseph. Those types of things don't last very long. Gratitude. So they could justify this, but it's not something which would evoke guilt. Because they weren't beating them up. They weren't physically abusing them. So whatever it was something which wouldn't cause any guilt. And in their own minds, the point was to rid ourselves of a problem. So they'll leave the country. But that didn't succeed. When that didn't succeed, it changed their attitude towards the Jews. It brought about a certain type of a disgust. That's absolutely necessary, because from a psychological standpoint. And that's what makes it possible to go to the next level. You have to understand the role of propaganda. You find that in Nazi Germany. All of the propaganda, the way they depicted the Jews, and the Christians did the same thing. The Jew was depicted as Satan with long nose or some type of a devil character to create a certain hatred and disgust. He's a disgusting type of a being. Essentially, it means to dehumanize. And all this is necessary. Always, wherever you find anti-Semitic decrees, especially where it involves the torture, execution, murder, and torture, there are certain innate restraints that people have. Everybody has a certain revulsion against murder, to begin with, anyways. And even the Nazis themselves, they would come home. You know, during the week they'd be killing Jews, then they'd come home, and they would have a compassion for other Germans. Even for their dogs, they'd have a compassion. Doesn't mean they uprooted the entire emotion of compassion, but it had to be uprooted with regard to the Jews. How could you do that? The answer is that they're not truly human. So as long as people regard you, accord you a certain respect as human beings, so it's impossible for them. They have the identification with you, and they can't kill. That's why I think that the Vayokutsu comes into play now. That a certain element of disgust takes over, and that changes their attitude, that enables them to impose these harsh decrees against them. And this is a completely new phase. And that's why it's a disaster for the Jews, because they no longer have any kind of a protection from the standpoint that the other side regards you as being ordinary humans who have rights, or whom one would hesitate to afflict. They now become objects of affliction. And first, one thing leads to another. That's another thing, is that once they get into the habit of afflicting you, it becomes second nature. Whatever. Even a criminal, the first time he commits a crime or the first time he murders someone, he may feel some pangs of guilt. And the second time, by the third time, it's second nature. It's no big deal. This is what happens over here. That they were able to afflict the Jews, to embitter their lives with all different manner of hard work, essentially treating them like they were animals. And it seems, the Pasuk is no longer telling us, giving us the specific reason behind this particular policy or that policy. It's intended to crush them. The idea of expulsion didn't work. They didn't leave. So now apparently the objective is to break them, to break their spirit in two ways. One is through, you have to deal with the current population to crush their strength by backbreaking labor and degradation. And the second one, this apparently at this point in time seems like a declaration of war. The second one is to prevent the growth. As a result of the first decree, they didn't interfere with their population growth. They continued to expand. And so apparently, the decree now was to prevent the expansion by eliminating all males. So the females would continue, but apparently that wasn't the threat. Apparently the idea was that they'll crush the existing population, and they'll the next generations will be eliminated in terms of the males. And eventually the females, what's going to happen to them? They're not going to be able, who are they going to marry? So either they'd be enslaved or they'd be taken over by the Egyptians. We don't know exactly. We don't know. But it seems that it wasn't genocidal in the Hitlerian sense of wiping out every Jew, because they didn't mind the girls. They did not mind. There was no problem. They had no problem with that. But the males, they were the ones that potentially could defend the nation and fight back. So the decree was limited to the males. Now we're going to turn to the story of the Mialdos, the midwives. And we already pointed out that according to Rashi, Shifra and Pua were not their real names, that this is really Yocheved and Miriam, the mother of Moshe and the sister of Moshe. Now let's take a look at the story. What is the story communicating to us? What is the key? Paro instructed the midwives to act with secrecy, that as soon as they discover that the child is a male, to dispose of it, and to do it in a way which would not draw attention. Even the mother wouldn't know. But if it's a girl, then keep her alive. The plan did not succeed. So what is the main idea? What do we learn from this? It's being suggested that the name, we do see certain name changes. For example, Avram, Avraham, which indicates a certain type of a level that's been achieved, or a certain type of transformation, if you will, a level which has been achieved. The name has to do with the essence of the individual. And indeed, the story over here is a story of a tremendous achievement. The Pasuk emphasizes the fact that the Mialdos feared God. Why does it have to tell you that? Why not simply say that they resisted for whatever reason? Midwives are women generally who are very attached to children, and this is an odious type of thing. Most midwives would rebel against this type of a decree. But the emphasis in this story, it's really a story about the fear of God. The Pasuk returns to that later on when it lingers with the Mialdos after their confrontation with Paro. And they stood up to Paro. And the last verse over here says, and it was because they feared God, so God made houses for them. That is dynasties in Israel. So the fear of God is extremely important over here. What is the Pasuk telling us then about the fear of God in conjunction with the deed?
Are you saying that they wouldn't even reckon with the decree?
I'm saying that the cause of what happens over here is the fact that they achieved a certain level of fear of God, and that's the only thing. In certain situations, there are certain tests, so to speak, that a person is exposed to, is subjected to, in which there's a conflict between his morality, his ethics, his beliefs, and some other force that's working on him. Now, any decent person would be horrified at this type of a decree, infanticide, innocent, just kill innocent children. However, even refined individuals, even moral people, even ethical people, in and of itself, there's no other force which would be sufficient to enable them to resist. It's only because they achieved a certain perfection in terms of the fear of God. That is to say, the capacity of man to rationalize, that man is basically selfish by nature, even good people, even compassionate people, but bottom line, it's all rooted in a certain kind of selfishness, and when the self is threatened, that's it. they're going to find ways of going along with it. Interestingly, that's what Avram told Avimelech at this point. Avimelech was very upset. We're cultured people. We're high-level people. How could you possibly think that we would kill you and steal your wife? We're not murderers. And one of the answers that Avram gave him was because he says, I saw that Rak ein yiras Elokim b'makom hazeh v'haraguni al dvarishti, that there's no fear of God in this place, and they'll kill me because of the matter of my wife. That is to say, whatever it is, it's not based upon a genuine fear of God. And there are certain... So therefore, a person is an animal. Without the fear of God, the person is essentially an animal. Because everything he's doing only because of animalistic factors. So that's a sophistication. He's proud of his ethics, his morality, whatever it is. But without the fear of God, that is to say that the only thing that mattered to them in this whole situation was the reality of God and their relationship with God. So therefore, the decree of Paro was nothing to them. And the consequences of what Paro might do was nothing. They knew what they had to do. They knew that their entire decision had to be based upon their fear of God. That was their essence. And you read about the Holocaust. I was just looking at a book review, a new book that just came out. I think I mentioned it yesterday. I did mention it. It's something you have to study, the behavior of the so-called bystanders. I mentioned that Elie Wiesel said he couldn't understand. Hitler he can understand, but he couldn't understand a Roosevelt or a Churchill. These were good people, and how could they be so completely indifferent? And in this book, he points out some of the rationalizations. After all is said and done, they simply stood idly by and made a conscious, calculated decision not to interfere, to let the Jews be killed, because there were many opportunities. Now, where was the fear of God? There was no fear of God. And all kinds of rationalizations, of political concerns, because there was resistance within the country, and the people thought if they thought that we're fighting the war in order to help the Jews, then the anti-Semitic factions would object, whatever, all kinds of calculations. I'm not saying that they had no merit, but they're absolutely absurd. A person that has a genuine fear of God, how could he stand by and allow innocent people to be killed? So there was no fear of God. They were good people. They were moral people, whatever you want to call them. But those type of people will find a way of going along with any kind of evil as long as it's essential to their primary purposes, their political purposes, whatever it is. They can make any kind of a pact with the devil, so to speak. The United States has done the same thing. Even with regard to Iraq, now they're the enemy. It wasn't too long ago when they supported dictators. I'm not criticizing the United States and so on and so forth. I'm just showing you that all of this, it's all talk, basically. Relatively speaking, we're superior to others. Relatively speaking. But the real test is the test of the Mialdos, and they achieved a certain level. A certain level in terms which was based upon their Yiras Hashem. That became their essence. And because they could have... See, there were many options that they could have, you know... Let's assume they didn't want to carry it out. They could have rationalized. They could have maybe killed a few and saved others, whatever. There were alternatives. Or they could have resigned. That's another thing. Why didn't they just resign and just say, we can't do it? They didn't even choose that path. Because the path of resigning would not have been the moral path. Because then you're acquiescing. Then Paro will find some other midwives and we will carry out the policy. So sometimes, a lot of times, a person resigns because they don't want to go along with a certain thing. Yeah, but it's true, but they are going along with it. Because by resigning, you're just paving the way. Now he'll choose somebody else and that person will carry out the policy. They didn't do that. They acted in a manner which saved the Jewish people. Had anybody else been in that position, then the Jewish people would have been destroyed. Clearly, that was an attempt to solve the problem, what they call a final solution. Had this been successful, then all of the males would have been killed. It would have devastated the Jews. And people would have stopped having children. That's part of the story of Amram and Yocheved, that they decided not to, they separated because there was no point in having children, and Miriam had to argue with them. So here, the Torah is pointing out that, and it could be also that this was a matter of divine providence, that it was just these two people who happened to be in that position. That's an extremely important point. And that perhaps is what the Torah is conveying, that that's the reason why. And the essence over here is not Miriam and Yocheved, that's their regular names. That's their names in terms of their relationship to mankind and others and so forth. So there's many aspects. But here, perhaps in a certain sense, if you want to look at it from the standpoint of providence, it's sort of like an angel. Angels are messengers of God. And perhaps that's part of it too, that it was not by accident that these people were in those positions. And they were angels in the sense. And therefore, angels too have special names, the name depicting their mission. The names of various angels that we encounter depict their mission. So their mission over here was to just be dedicated to one thing, to save those children. And perhaps that's the idea, that the only thing that matters over here is the name from the standpoint of their relationship with God. So you have a name in terms of your relationship to mankind, to people, and so forth, which expresses many different aspects of the person, of your personality. Here, they're being named from the standpoint of their relationship to God in that capacity, which was brought about by the perfection they achieved, or the transformation, perhaps, that they achieved as a result of their cultivation of a genuine Yiras Hashem, a genuine fear of God. And, of course, the genuine fear of God is not just an emotion of fear, but the emotion of fear, it's more than just an emotion of fear, obviously. It's a certain awe for the Creator. It's not in a simplistic sense that if I don't do this, God will punish me. And that may be part of it, but it's much more sophisticated. Bear in mind, however, this should not be confused with religious crazies who also profess a fear of God. And because they have a fear of God, they do the most heinous actions. They butcher people, they kill people in the name of God. That's not the genuine fear of God. The genuine fear of God has to express itself in terms of what is demanded of me in this situation. And that is, to the contrary, it's compassion. It's an awe of God's creations. And this is what gave them their capacity. They acted in a different sphere. The action over here was in a different sphere of human action. It's sort of, I guess, divine inspiration, you might call it. The Holy Spirit, so to speak. I'm just using the terms loosely. It could be that it was. The Rambam says that sometimes a person, that's a preliminary level of prophecy. He calls it Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit. And it's not necessarily a prophecy in terms of knowing the future, but rather deeds, great deeds, where a person is encouraged to defy all the forces that are arrayed against him, and he's operating on a completely different plane. He's not doing crazy things. He's acting with a certain calm, with a certain understanding, with a certain commitment, and he's able to execute certain deeds that the average person couldn't do. Such as the case of David, he says, when he fought against the Goliaths, that he reached a certain level of strength, of courage, of clarity. It's a certain perfected type of state that a person achieves. And I think it would make sense to say the same thing over here. That they achieved this level, and then they defied Paro. Not only... See, it's very, very important also to recognize what the pasuk is telling us, that it's not just that they didn't go along with what he said. That would be one level. There are certain people, perhaps, that they just couldn't kill the children. And that's it. But they went further than that. And they sustained them. They supported them. And Paro points that out to them. Not only did you not execute them as I commanded, but you went to the opposite. You supported them. You sustained them. And they gave their answer. It's a brilliant answer. Apparently he had nothing to say. Couldn't say anything. It was a stroke of genius to say this kind of an answer. Basically, he was saying that it's going to be an impossibility. That the women, the Jewish women, are too adept. And they're very quick. And they deliver their own children. By the time we get there, it's too late to maintain the secrecy. So that was their... That's the story of the Mialdos. So their personal names, anything personal, anything that has to do with personality, with ordinary situations, is completely irrelevant for this story. And I just want to conclude with the... We noticed there was a certain... unclarity in the last two psukim, that it seems that it starts off by saying God was good to them, and it doesn't tell you where the goodness was, and then it says that the nation increased. In the next pasuk it says that God made houses for them, that is, that they were the leaders of the house of the Kohanim and the house of kingship. That should be together with God was good to them. And the fact that the nation increased, that should be together with the beginning of verse 22. And it was because the midwives feared God. So then what should follow from that is, it was because of that that the nation increased. So it seems to be mixed up. However, I just would like to share an explanation that I had thought of a number of years ago. And that is that there is no real reward for the righteous in the ordinary sense, because ultimately all of the commandments are for the sake of a person's perfection. So when a person follows the will of God and improves himself, elevates the soul, that's the reward. So what does it mean that God was good to them? It's not in the ordinary sense that God, now I'm going to give you a reward because you did the right thing. Because you did the right thing, you rewarded yourself. You elevated yourself. That's the whole purpose of every mitzvah of the Torah, is to enable you to reach a higher level of existence in terms of your relationship with God. But the reward, however, there is a certain kind of a reward in the fact that when a person is dedicated to a certain ideal, which is in line with the will of God, so the person is successful in that area. That the reward, the fact that the nation increased and became mighty as a result of their efforts, that manifests itself as a tremendous source of satisfaction. So that, in a sense, is the reward. That the people increased and became very strong is connected with the fact that God benefited the midwives. And when a person engages in any kind of an activity to serve God for the true purpose, and that is a reward, that the efforts should be successful. Even though you can't... That's not the criterion. I mean, a lot of times a person tries. And the mere fact that a certain project doesn't succeed doesn't mean that it wasn't a big service of God, because there could be other factors involved. But clearly, for a righteous person, who's trying to advance the cause of Torah, and he sees the successful outcome of his labors, that's a tremendous, so to speak, reward for him, because it gives him a tremendous satisfaction. Now, the other part, and it was because the Miyad, see, so what we're saying is like this, the fact that God made houses for them, that they were the progenitors, or they were the leaders of these houses, that wasn't the reward. Because the righteous individual is not interested in that. So, the next verse which says that God made houses for them, that's not the reward. But rather, that's a result of the fact that they feared the Lord. And that in Israel, when you establish houses, so to speak, or dynasties of political leadership and spiritual leadership, the ultimate criterion are those, it's based upon, and it traces back to those who set the example in terms of the virtue of fear of God. That's the ultimate. Because every institution can become corrupted. So, of course, you need the wisdom, you need all kinds of qualities, but above all else must be the fear of God, this type of fear of God, which the midwives displayed. Again, as I'm saying, the many people will say, well, there's many religious people today that obviously fear God, and they do the most heinous things in the name of God. That's a falsification. That is a falsification. That's not true fear of God. Their whole religion is corrupt and falsified. It's just projecting their own emotions. Their whole idea of God and what God wants from a person is completely false. So obviously we're not talking about that. One must have a true concept of God and a correct understanding of the will of God. However, in order to achieve that, to fulfill that potential, one has to develop. That's something that a person has to work on. A person has to develop and raise the fear of God. The true fear of God has to be cultivated until that becomes the essence. And in anything you do, or anytime you're subjected to any kind of a challenge, you contemplate, what effect will this have with my relationship to God? So that all of mankind and the opinion of mankind is nothing to you. The only thing that matters is, what will God think of me? That is the ultimate perfection that a person can attain. And that's the story of the midwife.